There we go. Welcome, everybody, on this Valentine's Day, which is very interesting. We hope you're all doing well. So today our discussion is going to be, apropos Valentine's Day, about love and a little bit about how we see love and how we experience it and relationship to how the Buddha Dharma would look at it. And it's very interesting because trying to find information on this is not so easy. Although in the modern vernacular, or I say modern times, there's a lot of talk about love and the Dharma. In traditional suttas, we don't see much about love. Matter of fact, the real and only references I recall, and that could be limited to my memory, I'm happy to be corrected by anybody, are the references where the Buddha compares the love of a mother to its child as being the way we should feel about all human beings. That's one instance. And the other instance is where in the Dhammapada, which is one of the sayings of the Buddha, short book of the sayings of the Buddha, where the Buddha says that even if we were to carry our mother and father on each shoulder for the rest of our lives, it would be not enough to thank them and gratitude for having borne us. And so love is always raised in the context of a parent to a child. And it's almost never, and I don't recall ever, spoken about between partners or between lovers or between even in a married situation. And I think that's a very interesting thing. So based on that, I started to look up into the etymology of the word love. And it's very interesting. When we look back to the word love and trace it all the way back, as far back as we can go so far, and I'm quoting the Oxford sources because they're the ones that I found most easily, but I think we found some other sources as well. It goes back to Sanskrit, to a word called lubyat, which meant a kind of affection, attraction, and desire and love that then turned into the word libet, which went into Latin, which means also a form of attraction. And then that became lob, eventually in Old German, which then went into lufu in Frisian and Norsk, and eventually liebe in German, and then love in lief in Dutch, and love in English. The other thing I looked at was amor, which is what how they use in Latin, Italian, Spanish, and of course in French, amor. And in English, amorous has a certain kind of sensual, sexual kind of connotation, right? If a person is an amorous person, you're kind of hinting in a very polite way that they're somewhat promiscuous, right? Would that be what people would think of when they say, oh, that's yeah. A very amorous person. Promiscuous has a slight negative connotation. Amorous is saying it in a more genteel way, so you're not quite criticizing. And yet, amor comes from the word all the way back Sanskrit, amma, which refers to mother. And that is the bond between mother and child and the embracing. And more the sense of what in the Buddhist Dharma we talked about, where he references the love of a mother to its child. And amor or ama or amara comes close to meaning a bond, something of a bond. And in Old German, when love was used and then it got into Middle English, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, I did this quite quickly, 15 to 1600s. It actually referred to something more to desirous, romantic, sexual connotations. And thus in English, the term making love is very much an accurate use of the word love. Whereas when we say, oh, I love you with my heart, oh, but that's not sexual or anything, that's just my open love. That's actually a more modern interpretation of where the word comes from. When in Old English, love really more referred to the actual physical romantic aspect of love, which was making love, the action. So it's interesting to note how the meaning of words change and how the interpretation of words change. And from a Buddha Dharma point of view, connecting it to the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta, which is the Sutta on craving, if most of us think back in our lives and to the times that we would say we were in love or we felt love, let's use the word in love first. Most of us would generally say, well, we were pretty much very desirous at that time, weren't we? Desirous of whatever that object of our love was. And at the same time, we wanted the object of our love to be desirous of us, because that implied a certain mutuality there, a mutual codependent desirousness. And so we have a situation here where a conflict arises, as you can all see, a conflict between the concept of non-attachment, and I'm not using the word detachment, I'm using the word non-attachment, and releasing of craving or adhesion, and the concept of, oh, I want that adhesion, I want that closeness. And the feeling that we need to have that closeness, that physical bonding. And as humans in the physical body, we know that that kind of closeness is a tremendous, what should we say, a feeling of pleasure, a feeling of satisfaction, a feeling of security. In fact, you may all be familiar with, I'll just bring it up briefly, of the research that was done, I think, in the 1950s or early 60s, where they raised young monkeys in two situations. One, they had a surrogate mother, which was a wired form with fur and warmth and everything that the little baby monkey could hold on to and would have a bottle that would feed it. And other monkeys were raised completely devoid of any contact. And this is from almost birth. And the difference between the two monkeys when they reached maturity was stark and dramatic. The one monkey that had bonding to this, even though artificial, but warmth and nourishment, had a fairly normal type of monkey personality, while the other one could be pretty much classified as schizophrenic and psychotic. And so the research is very well known. So if you Google it, you'll be able to find it. And so they then presume that this is similar in humans, because we're all primates, that the closeness between the child and the mother at early stages, the bonding, physical bonding, is very important. And then from there, there's the extrapolation and the theorizing and the hypothesis that that is also something that transfers and grows with us as we become adults into wanting that closeness and bonding with other people. There are other psychologists that say that has a lot to do with wanting for procreation and the push of the genetic push to have the species procreate. All genes want to procreate. And so to have our species continue, and that, of course, leading to conception and birth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. An interesting fact that you may or may not be aware of is that it's fairly well established at this point that monogamy, or staying with one partner in one's whole life, is a very recent development in our species. And that until maybe the last few hundred years, humans were never expected or encouraged to stay monogamous. They were always said to go out and, you know, live their lives, and whatever children had would be taken care of. Now, people would say, well, what does Buddhism have to say about that? What does the Buddha Dharma have to say about that? And I guess if someone would come to me and ask me that question, the first response would be, is I don't even really think we have anything to say about that, because from a Buddha Dharma point of view, this is not in our purview, so to speak. This is not in our area of expertise, because if somebody is trying to live a life of non-attachment, then the whole theme of marriage, family, and upbringing is something that's not really front and forward. In fact, it was very interesting. I was recently listening, or I heard her was speaking to somebody, and they were talking about relationship, and they said they had a very interesting recollection when there was a speech they heard by the Dalai Lama, and someone was asking them, so, you know, tell us, what's the best way to raise a child? And the Dalai Lama's response is, why ask me? I'm a monk. I don't know anything about raising a child. And I thought that was such a wonderful response, because it's a true and honest response. There isn't much that a that a monk can actually say, or someone who is in the homeless light can actually say about raising children. So then what do we talk about when we talk about love from a Buddha Dharma point of view? That's an interesting question, isn't it? Let's go back to some of the things we've discussed briefly on our journey here. And of course you're getting Orin, or we use my ordained name, Padmapani's point of view, that it's essential, I believe, to understand that what the Buddha was teaching was a method and a path to nirvana, extinguishing of karma, complete release. I think to think and look at the Buddha in any other way is to romanticize it and to try and twist it and force it into our worldview today. That's my own personal point of view. Therefore, if we're not on that path, then what do we look at the Buddha Dharma for? And this comes back to our discussion always of philosophical means or practical philosophy of how to live a life as a human being in this world that we can feel happier, healthier, and more well-balanced, I think, with more harmony. So is there something, can we extract something from the Buddha Dharma in order to help us live in a more effective way, leading to greater contentment, leading to less conflict, leading to improved health? On the one hand, in response to that would be, yes, absolutely. Look at Vipassana, mindfulness. Mindfulness can help anybody. But if we follow, again, Padmapani's point of view, if the intention at the beginning is not the same intention of which it was originally founded, then the result won't be the same. Remember that? I talked about that about four classes before we got to this sutra. And now if we read this sutra, we see that everything has a condition for arising, right? And there are certain conditions, certain things arise. If you change the condition, the different things arise. If you feed the condition, then that will arise. If you want to not have that arise, then you have to stop the nutriment to that condition that leads to that arising. So based on that understanding of dependent origination applied to Vipassana or mindfulness practice, if the conditions of the practice are not with the same intent as they initially were, then the result cannot be the same as it initially was. Right? Is that clear? Everybody understand? If you disagree, please ask questions. Feel free to anytime interrupt and ask questions. This is not the word of God coming. This is just discussion, encouraging. So that leads to a very interesting question then. Did the Buddha, let's ask ourselves, did the Buddha teach Vipassana? First of all, did the Buddha create Vipassana? No. The practice of insight meditation existed before the Buddha. It existed from the Vedas. India at the time was one of the most spiritually rich cultures that has ever existed on this planet, even without the material wealth. So there were many different techniques. It was the technique that he managed to mold in his way and use to accomplish his goal. And it was the one that he found most effective after trying all of the ascetic practices, all the yogas, all the breathings, all the pranayamas, all the ascetic practices, and almost dying, and then coming back and trying all the other things, he arrived at this was most effective. Founded on what? What is Vipassana or Vipassana founded on? What's the essential practice? I've said this to you many times. What's the basic method?
Breathing.
Breathing, exactly. Breathing anapanasati. That's the foundation. And then on top of that, we put the mind, which is satipatthana. We start to reflect on the breathing. Okay, and what is happening? And we train the mind. And so then from there, we move to two types of meditation. One is pasana meditation, right? And the other is samadhi or samatha meditation, which is more the general. And Vipassana translate as insight, right? Looking specific at something and vision are the two words, vi and passa. So it's a specific way of looking at things. So the question then is, if we use vipassana with it under different conditions, can we use it in a way to accomplish the same results that the Buddha intended it to accomplish? If now we just said the Buddha's goal was complete liberation, we're not in that state of going into homelessness and complete liberation. Can we use vipassana for another result to benefit us, to make us happier, healthy, more well-balanced? And without losing or misdirecting the end result into something that's completely in another direction. Do we follow all the why I'm asking this question? So we have, I'll try to simplify it, review again. We have a method that was started here. We know that things come from certain conditions. We know we feed the conditions, then the results occur. We understand if we feed different conditions, then different results will result. Now, the question is, can we use this method for a different result and still benefit, or will it take us more into confusion and loss? There was an article in the BBC this week that I read that was very interesting. It said, the downside of mindfulness. And it was talking about how about 30% of the people that practice mindfulness end up having depression and having issues and having psychological problems because they're not suitable. In fact, the author wrote, I tried meditation, it doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work for me. So I do other things. I walk or I dance or I whatever. So by now, all of you should have a pretty clear grasp of what that person is saying and the strength or the weakness in that argument after what we've gone over together. Obviously, that fits exactly into the sutta we're discussing, that if there aren't the same conditions at the origin of the practice, then the conditions at the end won't be the same. And so if we take away the ethical foundation, we take away other factors and we isolate mindfulness and apply it to becoming more successful at business or hacking into some kind of app that will make life a different or using it to become a better athlete even, that doesn't necessarily guarantee us any greater happiness, contentment, or well-being in our life. That just guarantees us some better skill, which is the same thing as doing any other kind of exercise. And so the question really becomes, can we find a way to use vipassana that will benefit us without being completely committed to the total end result of what the Buddha was trying to get to? Now, do you understand why I'm asking that question? Do you all follow that? No?
Yeah.
Confusion? Yes? Anybody confused? Everybody's clear on why I'm going from there?
Yeah, very clear.
Okay. So, the answer now can tie in toward the beginning of our talk today, the issue of love. If love is an expression, and there's a psychological word called cathexis, C-A-T-H-E-X-I-S. And it means like lusting after something or desiring something or having to have something, a bond to it. It's not necessarily based on anything but just a kind of a physical attraction, physical need. If we want to experience love in a way that is more than that, and more than an expression of our deep-rooted psychological shortcomings as a result of things we've experienced from childhood onwards, which all of us have, then being able to see clearly what it is that we feel when we see another person is very important. Agreed? And practicing vipassana and getting good at it will help us do that.